A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. His son Ezra is closing in on his first birthday, and he's deep in that phase where every object within reach is basically a research subject. He's been watching Ezra play with a plastic Eurobox, one of those stacking storage crates, and it got him thinking, when is it fine to let a baby gnaw on whatever's handy, and when should you actually worry? He's specifically asking about surface treatments, plastics, BPA, lead in metal objects, the chemical safety side of mouthing random household items. His instinct is to be permissive for the sake of development, but judicious about what he actually allows. So where do we even start with this?
I love this question because it sits right at the intersection of developmental science and materials chemistry, and most parenting advice only covers one or the other. Let's start with what's actually happening in Ezra's brain right now. At 11 months, the mouth is the highest resolution sensory organ a baby has. The lips and tongue have more nerve endings per square millimeter than fingertips do. When he puts that Eurobox in his mouth, he's not just gnawing. He's measuring temperature, texture, hardness, and density simultaneously. It's a full materials analysis lab.
He's running a spectroscopy rig with his gums.
And this isn't just cute behavior. It's how the brain builds the somatosensory cortex. Every time he mouths an object, he's laying down neural pathways that connect tactile sensation to object properties. Smooth plastic feels different from textured plastic, which feels different from cool metal or rough wood. Those distinctions form the foundation for fine motor control later. Kids who are restricted from mouthing during this phase don't get developmental delays necessarily, but they do get less sensory data to work with.
Which is why Daniel's instinct to not constantly take things away is sound. The question is where the chemical risk line actually falls, because I suspect a lot of parental anxiety here is driven by headlines rather than data.
Let's take BPA first, since it's the one everyone's heard of. Bisphenol A was used as a hardening agent in polycarbonate plastics for decades. Baby bottles, sippy cups, the lining of formula cans. The concern emerged in the late 90s and early 2000s when researchers found it could leach out under heat and acidic conditions, and it's an endocrine disruptor. It mimics estrogen in the body. The key study that shifted policy was a 2008 paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association that linked urinary BPA levels to cardiovascular disease and diabetes in adults.
That's when the industry scrambled.
Scrambled is the right word. By 2012, the FDA banned BPA in baby bottles and sippy cups. Canada had already done it in 2010. The industry reformulated fast, and here's the thing most parents don't realize. The replacement plastics, the ones labeled BPA-free, are often made with bisphenol S or bisphenol F, which are chemically similar and may have the same endocrine-disrupting properties. There was a paper in Environmental Health Perspectives in 2015 showing BPS had comparable estrogenic activity, so BPA-free is partly a marketing term.
The whack-a-mole approach to chemical regulation.
Replace one molecule with its cousin, slap a new label on it, and hope the research takes another decade to catch up. But let's bring this back to Ezra and that Eurobox. The actual risk of BPA exposure from a rigid plastic storage crate in 2026 is near zero for two reasons. One, polycarbonate isn't typically used for those crates. They're usually polypropylene or polyethylene, which don't contain bisphenols at all. Two, even if trace amounts were present, the leaching requires heat or prolonged liquid contact. A baby gnawing on a dry, room temperature plastic surface isn't extracting meaningful quantities.
The Eurobox is probably fine, but what about the broader category of random plastic things? Because a storage crate is one thing, but babies get their mouths on everything. Remote controls, phone cases, toy packaging.
This is where you need a mental triage system. The highest risk plastics are soft, flexible PVC, the kind used in inflatable toys, shower curtains, some cheap bath toys, because they contain phthalates as plasticizers. Phthalates are also endocrine disruptors, and they're not chemically bonded to the plastic. They leach out continuously, especially when wet or chewed. The EU banned 6 phthalates in children's articles back in 1999, and the US Consumer Product Safety Commission followed with a permanent ban in 2017 on anything that can be placed in a child's mouth. But here's the gap that applies to manufactured children's products. A random household item that wasn't designed for kids isn't covered by the same standard.
The bath toy designed for babies is regulated, but the shower curtain ring that falls on the floor and looks fascinating is not.
And that's the practical challenge Daniel is navigating. The permissive general advice he's reading is probably based on the fact that most rigid household plastics, storage bins, furniture, appliance casings, are polypropylene, polyethylene, or ABS, none of which contain bisphenols or phthalates. The risk profile is genuinely low. Where it gets trickier is with painted or coated surfaces and with metals.
Let's talk metals then, because Daniel mentioned lead specifically, and that's the one where the anxiety seems most justified to me.
Lead is a different category of concern entirely. There is no safe blood lead level in children. The CDC says this explicitly. Even low-level exposure affects IQ, attention, and behavior permanently. The primary vector for babies isn't paint chips from windowsills the way it was in the 1970s. It's imported metal objects, costume jewelry, keys, and surprisingly, some ceramic glazes. In 2023, there was a major recall of children's metal water bottles sold on Amazon because the bottom seal contained lead solder. A baby mouthing the base of that bottle would get direct exposure.
Brass keys? People hand their babies keys to play with all the time.
Brass is an alloy of copper and zinc, but it often contains a small percentage of lead to improve machinability. The lead content in brass keys can be 2-3% by weight. When a baby mouths a brass key, the combination of saliva, which is slightly acidic, and mechanical abrasion from teeth can release lead ions. There was a study in the Journal of Environmental Health in 2011 that tested keys and found lead release above the permissible limit for children's products in a significant fraction of samples. Newer keys tend to be better, but unless you know the alloy, you're guessing.
What's the practical filter here? If I'm Daniel, standing in my living room watching Ezra pick up an object, what's the quick mental checklist before I decide to intervene or not?
I'd suggest a 3-question filter. First, is this object designed to be mouthed? If yes, pacifier, teether, designated toy, it's almost certainly food-grade silicone or tested plastic, and you're done. Second, if it's not designed for mouthing, is it rigid or flexible? Rigid plastics are low risk, flexible squishy plastics are the ones where phthalates live. Third, if it's metal, is it a known food contact material? Stainless steel is fine. Aluminum is fine if anodized. Brass, pewter, soldered joints, those warrant intervention.
What about wood? I feel like wood is the material everyone assumes is safe because it's natural. But natural doesn't mean inert.
Wood is actually a fascinating case. Untreated, unfinished wood is one of the safest things a baby can mouth. Wood has natural antimicrobial properties. Studies have shown that wood cutting boards harbor fewer bacteria than plastic ones because the wood fibers wick moisture away and the tannins have a mild antibacterial effect. But the moment you add a finish, you've introduced an unknown. Varnishes, lacquers, and stains can contain solvents, heavy metal dryers, and fungicides. A piece of furniture that's been stained and sealed is not the same as a raw wooden block.
The untreated wooden spoon from the kitchen is great, but the varnished table leg is not.
And there's a nuance here around bamboo. Bamboo cutting boards and utensils are often marketed as eco-friendly and natural, but bamboo isn't wood, it's a grass. And bamboo products are almost always made by grinding the fibers and binding them with resin under heat and pressure. That resin is often a melamine formaldehyde compound. It's stable at room temperature, but if a baby is gnawing on it and generating friction and saliva, there's a potential for formaldehyde release. Formaldehyde is a known carcinogen and respiratory irritant. The EU has stricter limits on formaldehyde emissions from composite wood products than the US does.
The natural bamboo spoon is actually a processed composite with resin binders. That's exactly the kind of non-obvious risk I think Daniel is trying to navigate.
It highlights why the question is so good. The surface-level advice, let them explore, it's good for development, is correct in principle, but incomplete without the material's knowledge to back it up. Most parents don't have a chemistry background, and they shouldn't need one. The gap is that consumer product labeling doesn't serve this use case. A storage crate isn't labeled with its polymer composition because it's not intended for oral contact. But babies don't read labels.
The baby is the ultimate unintended use case.
The baby is a chaos agent who treats every object as a potential snack.
Which brings us to surface treatments. Daniel specifically mentioned being uneasy about surface treatments and coatings. What's the landscape there?
Surface treatments fall into a few categories. Paints are the obvious one. Modern interior latex paints are low, VOC, and relatively safe once cured. The volatile organic compounds off-gas during the first few days to weeks after application, and then the polymer film is essentially inert. The concern is older paint, which may contain lead, or imported painted items where the manufacturing standards are unknown. The U.S. banned lead in residential paint in 1978, but that only applies to paint manufactured or sold in the U.S. Imported decorative items, toys, and furniture can still have lead-based paint. There was a widely reported case in 2007 where Mattel recalled nearly a million toys because of lead paint from a Chinese subcontractor.
Vintage painted furniture, imported decorative boxes, anything where the paint provenance is unknown. Those are the ones to intercept.
The second category is clear coatings, varnishes, polyurethane, shellac. Once fully cured, these are generally food safe. Polyurethane is used to seal wooden salad bowls and butcher blocks. The key word is fully cured. Curing can take days to weeks depending on the product, humidity, and temperature. A freshly varnished table is off-gassing solvents that you don't want a baby inhaling, let alone mouthing. But a piece that's been in the house for years? The coating is polymerized and inert.
What about metal coatings? Galvanized steel, chrome plating, that sort of thing?
Chrome plating is electroplated onto the surface and is extremely hard and non-reactive. That's why it's used on bathroom fixtures. It's not a concern for mouthing. Galvanized steel is coated with zinc, and zinc is actually an essential nutrient, though you don't want a baby ingesting zinc oxide flakes. In practice, the zinc coating on galvanized steel is tightly bonded and not going to transfer from casual mouthing. The bigger concern with metal is not the coating but the substrate, what the metal actually is, and whether it contains lead, cadmium, or other heavy metals.
We've covered plastics, metals, wood, paints, and coatings. What about the category Daniel didn't mention, but that's probably in his house? Textiles? Babies mouth fabric constantly. Clothes, blankets, stuffed animals?
Textiles are an under-discussed vector. The main concern is flame retardants. For decades, polybrominated diphenyl ethers, PBDEEs, were added to upholstery foam, carpets, and children's pajamas to meet flammability standards. They're persistent in the environment, they bioaccumulate, and they're associated with thyroid disruption and neurodevelopmental effects. The good news is that PBDEs were largely phased out by 2013, and California's updated flammability standard, TB117-2013, actually reduced the need for chemical flame retardants in upholstered furniture by allowing smolder-resistant covers instead.
Newer textiles are better, but what about hand-me-downs and second-hand items?
That's exactly where the exposure risk concentrates. Older foam products, car seats, nursing pillows, mattress pads, can still contain PBDEs, and the chemicals migrate out of the foam and into household dust. A baby mouthing a fabric item isn't getting direct transfer so much as they're getting dust exposure, which is then compounded by hand-to-mouth behavior. The advice here is practical. Vacuum frequently with a HEPA filter, wash new textiles before use, and be cautious with secondhand foam products manufactured before 2014.
The dust angle is one of those things that sounds paranoid until you look at the exposure pathways. Babies are basically floor-dwelling creatures. They're in constant contact with whatever settles on surfaces.
Their hand-to-mouth transfer rate is orders of magnitude higher than adults. There was a study in Environmental Science and Technology in 2016 that measured flame retardant levels in children's blood and found they were 3 to 5 times higher than their mothers. The primary pathway wasn't diet, it was house dust.
Which is a sobering data point. But let's not lose the forest here. Daniel's core question is about where to draw the line with Ezra's exploration. And I think what's emerging from this conversation is that the line isn't a single bright boundary. It's a set of heuristics that get applied differently depending on the object.
And I'd add that the developmental cost of over-restriction is real. When a parent constantly intervenes, no, don't touch that, put that down, that's not for babies, the baby learns that exploration is punished. They don't learn to discriminate between safe and unsafe objects. They just learn that reaching for things makes the parent anxious. Over time, that can suppress the exploratory drive that underpins cognitive development.
The goal isn't to create a sterile bubble. It's to create an environment where most of what's within reach is safe, so you don't have to intervene constantly.
The ideal setup is what child development researchers call a yes space, an area where everything the baby can access is safe for mouthing, climbing, and general investigation. That doesn't mean everything needs to be a certified baby toy. It means the objects in that space have been vetted: rigid plastics, untreated wood, stainless steel, food-grade silicone, natural fabrics. When the baby picks something up, the default answer is yes.
The Eurobox Daniel mentioned, a rigid polypropylene storage crate, probably passes that vetting without issue. It's boring enough to be safe and interesting enough to hold a baby's attention for an hour, which is basically the sweet spot.
The boring adult object sweet spot is underrated. Babies are often more engaged with real household items than with toys, precisely because those items are embedded in the adult world they're trying to understand. A plastic storage crate is a container. It has volume. It can be stacked. It makes a satisfying sound when you bang on it. Those are all legitimate learning experiences.
The Glockenspiel of domestic life.
And that's the thing, a toy Glockenspiel is designed to be mouthed and banged on. A plastic crate is not, but it serves the same function and costs nothing. The only question is whether the materials are safe, and for rigid polypropylene, the answer is yes.
Let's talk about a few specific household items that parents commonly hand to babies without thinking. Car keys, we covered those. What's the risk ranking?
Remote controls are interesting. The casing is typically ABS plastic, which is fine. The concern is the silicone button pad underneath. Older remotes sometimes used carbon-impregnated silicone that can shed particles. But the bigger issue is that remotes are high-touch surfaces that rarely get cleaned. The microbial load on a TV remote is often higher than on a toilet seat. That's not a chemical safety issue, but it's worth noting for a baby who's putting it in their mouth.
The remote is a hygiene problem, more than a toxicity problem.
Phone cases are more variable. Hard polycarbonate cases are fine. Soft TPU cases, thermoplastic polyurethane, are generally safe. TPU doesn't require phthalate plasticizers. The ones to watch out for are the very cheap, very flexible cases that have a strong chemical smell. That smell is off-gassing plasticizers, and those are the ones that might contain phthalates. If it smells like a new shower curtain, keep it away from the baby.
The sniff test as a parenting tool.
It's crude, but surprisingly effective. Your nose is a decent detector for volatile organic compounds. If something smells strongly chemical, your baby shouldn't be mouthing it. If it has no odor, that doesn't guarantee safety, but it eliminates a whole category of concern.
What about cardboard and paper? Ezra's almost certainly going to encounter boxes, mail, books.
Cardboard and paper are generally low risk. The fiber itself is cellulose, completely inert and indigestible, which is why babies can pass small amounts without issue. The concerns are inks and recycled content. Soy-based inks, which are standard in most packaging now, are safe. Older or imported printed materials might use petroleum-based inks with heavy metal pigments. Recycled cardboard can contain residual chemicals from the original products, detergent boxes, for example, or packaging that had contact with cleaning products. The risk is low for occasional mouthing, but I wouldn't let a baby systematically chew and swallow cardboard.
Books are another one. Board books are designed for mouthing and are printed with safe inks, but regular books with glossy covers.
Glossy coatings on book covers and magazines are often clay-based and inert. The shinier the coating, the more likely it's a mineral rather than a plastic film. Magazine covers sometimes use a UV-cured coating that's essentially a thin layer of polymerized resin. Once cured, it's stable. Again, occasional mouth contact is negligible. The binding glue might be the bigger variable, but for brief contact, it's not a meaningful exposure pathway.
The through line here seems to be, most household objects present negligible acute risk from casual mouthing, with specific exceptions around soft plastics, unknown metal alloys, and old or imported painted surfaces. The chronic exposure risks, flame retardants in dust, phthalates in flexible plastics, are more about the cumulative environment than any single object.
That's the key insight. Parents tend to fixate on the acute risk. What happens if he puts this specific thing in his mouth right now? When the public health data suggests the bigger concern is the cumulative low-level exposure from the overall household environment. Dust, air, food packaging, personal care products. The single Euro box is a rounding error compared to the phthalates in the vinyl flooring or the flame retardants in the couch foam.
Which is simultaneously reassuring and unsettling. Reassuring because the object you just let your baby play with probably didn't poison him. Unsettling because the things you can't see and don't think about might be doing more.
Welcome to Environmental Health in the 21st Century. The actionable takeaway for Daniel, I think, is this. Focus your intervention energy on the high-leverage items. Soft plastic bath toys, old painted furniture, brass keys, anything with a strong chemical smell. Those are worth intercepting. The rigid plastic storage crate, the wooden spoon, the stainless steel bowl, the cardboard box, those are fine. And beyond individual objects, manage the environment. Vacuum with a HEPA filter, wash hands before meals, open windows for ventilation, and choose fragrance, free personal care products.
Fragrance is a whole other rabbit hole. The term fragrance on a label can legally hide dozens of undisclosed chemicals, some of which are phthalates used as fixatives.
It's one of the biggest regulatory loopholes in consumer products. The FDA doesn't require disclosure of individual fragrance ingredients because they're considered trade secrets. The International Fragrance Association maintains a list of several thousand possible ingredients, and manufacturers just list fragrance or parfum on the label. For a baby who's mouthing everything and has a developing endocrine system, fragrance-free is the safer default for laundry detergent, soap, lotion, and cleaning products.
That connects back to the mouthing behavior directly. If Ezra is chewing on his own sleeve, and that sleeve was washed in a heavily fragranced detergent, he's getting direct oral exposure to whatever's in that fragrance formulation.
The sleeve becomes a delivery mechanism. That's another reason why the environmental approach matters more than policing individual objects. The objects are all interconnected through the household systems. The laundry detergent, the floor cleaner, the air freshener, the couch treatment. They all end up in the same dust that settles on every surface the baby touches.
Let's step back for a moment and talk about the developmental side, because I think there's a psychological dimension to Daniel's question that's worth naming. He said he doesn't want to keep taking things away because it limits developmental opportunities. That's a thoughtful framing, and it suggests he's wrestling with the tension between protection and permission.
That tension is the defining feature of modern parenting, I think. We have more information about risks than any generation before us, and more products marketed to mitigate those risks, and the net effect can be a kind of paralysis. Every object becomes a potential hazard to be evaluated. And the baby, who is just trying to learn about the world, keeps getting the message that their curiosity is dangerous.
The paradox of the informed parent. The more you know, the harder it is to relax.
Here's what the developmental research actually shows. Babies learn best through self-directed exploration with real objects. There was a fascinating study from MIT in 2015 where researchers gave babies a novel object and watched how they investigated it. The babies who were allowed to mouth, bang, and manipulate the object freely learned its properties faster than babies who were shown the object by an adult. The mouthing wasn't incidental, it was central to the learning process. The babies who mouthed the object were more likely to discover that it rattled, or that one end was heavier than the other, or that the surface texture changed.
The mouth is literally a discovery tool. Taking away the object isn't just removing a hazard, it's interrupting a research program.
A research program that the baby designed and is running. And babies are surprisingly good at self-regulating. They don't typically swallow non-food objects. The gag reflex in infants is triggered much further forward on the tongue than in adults. It's a protective mechanism. Mouthing is about exploration, not ingestion.
Which is why the chemical risk from surface contact is the right thing to focus on, rather than choking hazards or ingestion, which babies are actually fairly good at avoiding on their own.
The body has layers of defense. The problem is that those defenses evolved for a world of sticks and stones and dirt, not a world of polycarbonate and phthalates and flame retardants. The mouth can detect texture and temperature and hardness, but it can't detect bisphenol A.
The nose can detect some of it. We talked about the sniff test. But you're right, the sensory apparatus hasn't caught up to the industrial chemistry.
Which is why the parent has to be the external sensory system for those invisible risks. But the goal isn't to evaluate every object in real time. The goal is to curate the environment so that real-time evaluation isn't necessary.
Curate is the right word. It's not about baby-proofing in the sense of locking everything away. It's about making sure that what's accessible is fine.
The developmental payoff of that approach is substantial. When a baby spends an hour with a plastic storage crate, stacking it, mouthing it, banging it, turning it over, putting things inside it, they're learning about containment, about gravity, about sound, about texture, about object permanence. That's not wasted time. That's a rich learning experience that happens to cost nothing and require no special equipment.
The Eurobox as Montessori material.
Maria Montessori's whole philosophy was that children learn best from real objects in a prepared environment. The prepared environment is the key. It's the parent's job to prepare it, and then the child's job to explore it freely. What Daniel is doing by leaving the Eurobox on the ground and letting Ezra engage with it is basically Montessori practice, whether he's framing it that way or not.
The anxiety he's feeling. Is this plastic safe? Is the modern parent's version of preparing the environment? He's trying to figure out what belongs in the prepared space and what doesn't.
Which is exactly the right question. The answer for the specific Eurobox he described is almost certainly yes, it belongs. Rigid polypropylene or polyethylene, no BPA, no phthalates, no coatings. It's one of the safest categories of plastic in the typical household.
What about the longevity of this phase? Daniel mentioned he knows it will eventually come to an end. How long does the mouthing phase typically last?
The peak is between 6 and 12 months, which is exactly where Ezra is now. It typically starts to decline around 15 to 18 months as fine motor skills improve and the hands become the primary exploration tools. By age 2, most children have largely stopped mouthing non-food objects, though some oral sensory seeking can persist longer, especially in children who are later found to have sensory processing differences.
Daniel is in the thick of it, but the light at the end of the tunnel is maybe 6 months away.
In those 6 months, Ezra will cover an enormous amount of developmental ground. He'll go from cruising to walking, from babbling to first words, from grasping to manipulating. The mouthing supports all of that by building the sensory foundations. So the investment in getting the environment right now pays off across multiple developmental domains.
Let's circle back to one specific thing Daniel mentioned that we haven't addressed directly. He said the general advice he's read is more permissive than he expected. I think that's worth unpacking, because it might reflect a shift in how pediatric guidance is evolving.
I think there has been a shift. The older advice, from the 90s and early 2000s, was much more cautious. Everything needed to be a designated toy. Everything needed to be sterilized. The subtext was that the world is full of hazards, and the parent's job is to be a vigilant gatekeeper. The newer advice recognizes that this level of vigilance is both impossible and counterproductive. The American Academy of Pediatrics has moved toward a more balanced approach that emphasizes safe environments over constant intervention.
The pendulum swinging from hypervigilance to managed freedom.
The data supports the swing. Rates of accidental poisoning in young children have actually declined over the past 2 decades, despite, or perhaps because of, the shift toward environmental management rather than object-by-object policing. When you make the environment safe, you don't have to say no as often, and when you don't have to say no as often, the times you do say no carry more weight.
That's a parenting insight that applies far beyond mouthing. Save your no's for when they matter.
If you're saying no 20 times an hour, no becomes background noise. If you're saying no twice a day because the environment is curated, those no's actually register.
What would a practical weekend project look like for Daniel and Hannah? If they wanted to do a quick audit of their living space with Ezra's mouthing phase in mind,
I'd suggest a 1-hour walkthrough with a box. Go room by room at Ezra's eye level. Literally get down on the floor and look at what's accessible. Anything flexible and plasticky with a chemical smell goes in the box. Anything painted where you don't know the paint source goes in the box. Any metal object that isn't clearly stainless steel or anodized aluminum goes in the box. Any small object with a battery compartment, because batteries are a severe ingestion hazard, goes way up high, not just in the box.
The battery point is worth underlining. Button batteries are probably the single most dangerous household object for a mouthing baby.
They're terrifying. If a button battery is swallowed, it can cause esophageal perforation within 2 hours. The saliva completes the circuit, and the resulting electrical current causes tissue burns. It's not a toxicity issue. It's an electrical burn inside the body. Every year, thousands of children are seen in emergency departments for battery ingestion, and the outcomes can be catastrophic. If there's one thing in the house that justifies true vigilance, it's button batteries.
The triage hierarchy is button batteries at the top as an absolute emergency, then soft plastics and unknown metals as things to remove, then everything else is probably fine with some basic vetting.
That's a solid summary. And I'd add, trust your nose, favor rigid over flexible, favor unfinished over finished, and remember that the cumulative environment matters more than any single object. The Eurobox on the patio is not the thing keeping you up at night.
The thing keeping you up at night is the baby himself, for entirely different reasons.
That's a different episode.
So to wrap the core discussion, Daniel's instinct to be permissive but judicious is well calibrated. The Eurobox is fine. The developmental benefits of mouthing are real and well documented. The risks concentrate in specific categories. Soft PVC, unknown metal alloys, old paint, button batteries, and those are manageable with a one-time environmental audit. The phase ends, the brain grows, and the parent's job is less about policing individual objects and more about curating the space so policing isn't needed.
That's the takeaway. And I'd add one thing for Daniel specifically, since he mentioned not having family in the country. When you don't have grandparents or aunts and uncles around to hand down the informal knowledge, oh, we just let you chew on a wooden spoon and you turned out fine. You end up doing more research. That's not a bad thing. You're building your own institutional knowledge from scratch, and the fact that you're asking about BPA and surface treatments means you're doing it thoughtfully.
The DIY village.
It's harder, but the questions are better.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Tardigrade physiologists in the late Victorian period discovered that specimens collected on Sakhalin Island could survive complete desiccation for over a decade. But the unintended consequence was that dried moss samples shipped to European museums kept reintroducing the same tardigrade lineages to university laboratories, contaminating what researchers thought were separate evolutionary lines for nearly 30 years.
Victorian tardigrades were basically stowaways in the scientific supply chain. This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, and to Daniel for the question. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show. We'll be back soon.
Talk to you then.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.